Good morning. It is Wednesday, October 5th, 2016. I'd like to call this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. All three commissioners are present. That constitutes a quorum. First up, our monthly recognition of county employees who have reached service milestones. I would like to ask each of these 4 years and hopefully before that. Our next agenda item is consideration of a resolution for Lincoln County to join the National Stepping Up Initiative to reduce the number of people with mental illness in jails. And this comes after a couple of months of groundwork. I've been working with Mr. Steve Sparks. Steve, if you would stand, please. And a whole lot of people are here today because of stepping up. So in the spirit of the resolution, could I ask you all, please, to step up? So I think this is one sign of the commitment and support that's already been laid out here. You can sit now. Thanks. But I will read the resolution. Then we've got a very short video and a PowerPoint presentation that hopefully will give you a picture of what this is all about. Whereas counties routinely provide treatment services to the estimated 2 million people with serious mental illness booked into jail each year, and whereas prevalence rates of serious mental illness in jails are 3 to 6 times higher than for the general population, and whereas almost 3/4 of adults with serious mental illness in jails have co-occurring substance use disorders, and whereas adults with mental illness tend to stay longer in jail and upon release are at a higher risk of recidivism than people without these disorders, and whereas county jails spend 2 to 3 times more on adults with mental illness that require interventions compared to those without treatment needs, and whereas without the appropriate treatment and services, people with mental illness continue to cycle through the criminal justice system, often resulting in tragic outcomes for these individuals and their families, and whereas Lincoln County and all counties take pride in their responsibility to protect and enhance the health, welfare, and safety of its residents in efficient and cost-effective ways, whereas, pardon me, through stepping up, the National Association of Counties, the Council of State Governments Justice Center, and the American Psychiatric Association Foundation are encouraging public, private, and nonprofit partners to reduce the number of people with mental illness in jails. Now, therefore, let it be resolved that the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners does hereby sign on to the call to action to reduce the number of people with mental illness in our county jail, commit to sharing lessons learned with other counties in our state and across the country to support a national initiative, and encourage all county officials, employees, and residents to participate in stepping up. We have produced a 2-minute informational video about stepping up. I'd like to have Casey show that now.
I'm Lincoln County Sheriff Curtis Landers. Our jails were never meant to house mentally ill people. Incarcerating mentally ill individuals is ineffective and further degrades the condition of the person because they cannot obtain the help they need. This is why Lincoln County is joining Stepping Up, a joint effort of the National Association of Counties, the Council of State Governments, and the American Psychiatric Association. The right investments now will produce better outcomes in the long run. Sending people through our court system and to our jail or the state prison system again and again is very costly. We can have better outcomes and at less cost.
Now, if we can switch to the PowerPoint, which expands on this just a little bit more. Okay. I think the first important point for everybody to be aware of is we're not starting from ground zero on this. It's not creating something new. It's building on and hopefully accelerating what we already have. For instance, we've had the jail inmate counselor in place since 1992. The mental health court was established in 2010. Health and Human Services, as we heard a few weeks ago, has obtained a grant that will allow the launch of mobile crisis services in 2017. So we've already got some key pieces in place. So why do we need stepping up? What does this give us? Well, first, I think real branding and focus. Also, it makes us eligible for technical support from the National Association of Counties and others. And again, hopefully stronger engagement of the community. And finally, better positioning if and when new resources do come available. So why is the timing right? There really finally seems to be bipartisan federal consensus on the need for mental health reform. There's a lot of discussion and hopefully action coming at the state level on reform, especially as I reported a couple of weeks ago about the meeting I attended, the tremendous costs associated with the aid and assist population. There's actually a settlement agreement between the U.S. Department of Justice and the state of Oregon mandating some of these reforms. Another plus, the state has just obtained a federal grant that for the first time is going to provide support to our local public safety coordinating councils. And we're all set to fold this effort under the Mental Health Subcommittee of LIPSC. We won't have a full-time staff person here. We're going to be sharing that position with the other counties in our region. But at least for the first time, we would have some dedicated staffing support to our LIPSC. So at least in theory, it should be able to help move this forward. As I said, we've been working on this for a couple of months. We've had Mr. Sparks on board. The two of us have been doing a lot of research, conducting a lot of meetings, and developed a preliminary plan. So where do we go from here? A sequential intercept mapping exercise is key. I'll talk more about that in a moment. We would need to look at further technical assistance. There is a lot of interest in accelerating mental health first aid and crisis intervention training for law enforcement, including a commitment from our sheriff's office and our community corrections to do that. We really need to take a hard look at data collection and sharing practices. And then ultimately, you know, the best coordination planning is only going to be so effective if we can't get more treatment, supporting services, and housing opportunities. That's the long-range part of it. That's the big part. But at least this hopefully gets us on a path to do that. This chart, and really, unfortunately, it's too small to be seen, but it describes sequential intercept mapping. It's been around for about 15 years. And basically, it identifies each point where a person with mental illness can interact with the justice system. And the goal is to divert them into treatment at whatever the appropriate point might be. Here's another view of the model, looking at it as a series of filters. And for people who are interested, the Board of Commissioners meeting packet is online, and it includes this PowerPoint presentation. So there's going to need to be a lot of protocols put in place to make this work, including information sharing, And then, as I said, the resources to provide these diversions. Good data is key, and that's why we've reached out to our own IT department right in this from the start. Because data, you know, for one thing, it drives decisions and outcomes. It also drives funding. I was at a meeting a few weeks ago, and somebody said, I wrote this down, I thought it nailed it perfectly. You get funded the first time on an idea. To get funded the second time, you need outcomes that have been documented with good data. Again, we're not going it alone. Potential partners there, our neighboring counties, NACO, AOC, Samaritan Health, and the IHN-CCO. We've already done outreach to those folks. They're very interested. Lincoln County School District, Oregon Coast Community College, private providers. I think some new and expanded public-private partnerships can help really build a strong network here. And ultimately, private funders. So, what are the expected outcomes? Reducing recidivism, which is so costly. Reducing early releases from jail, because even though we do have the 161-bed capacity in jail, we know that there is a constant challenge with matrix-driven early releases. If we can get some of these folks diverted from the jail in the first place, at least in theory, we're going to be able to keep the people who truly need to be there, reduce costly emergency room admissions, reduce criminal acts linked to mental illness, and then improved outcomes for people dealing with mental illness, addiction, and trauma. You know, that's the big picture. That's the pie in the sky. We're never going to eliminate this problem, but these are proven strategies that I think really can reduce them. The momentum is building. As of last week, 300 counties around the country had signed on to stepping up. That represents 10% of all counties in the country, in 41 states, 35% of the population. So the question to my colleagues now is, are we ready to step up?
Well, I have questions.
Yes, sir.
Since the first time I've seen this presentation.
Yes.
I agree the problem's real.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree the coordination part of it is a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
But where's the money come for the housing when you take the people out of the jails? We have done all, every time we get into a program like this, we got to identify where funds come from. So where's the money come from to increase treatment? And where's the money come from to increase housing?
Can't give you a definitive answer on either of those, except to say that all the discussions at the in both Washington and Salem really are focusing on the problem and acknowledging that we've got to get new resources in here. I told you about a month ago the meeting I went to in Salem with the Oregon Health Authority, again just talking about the people who wind up in the state hospital because of their for an aid and assist evaluation. Average cost of stay, $1,000 a day. Average length of stay, 66 days. All of that's coming out of the state general fund. And the director of the Oregon Health Authority said, we could provide these people a year of housing in the community and treatment for less than $66,000. So getting the shift in funding, getting the housing in place, getting the treatment capacity in place, I'll be the first to say that's not going to be a simple task by any means, but at least this, by us signing on to this, it commits us to saying we realize it's a problem, we know it needs to be addressed, and we'll be part of the effort to shift and reprioritize the spending of those resources.
Okay, there's one other problem that I see in this kind mm-hmm. of thing after years of being in legislature mm-hmm. stuff and being in local government. And that relates to unfunded mandates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just mentioned that there was a mandate there, but there's no funds that follow. Like I say, I'm 100% supportive of this, but I would feel more comfortable if I heard exactly where money was supposed to be shifted from to, rather than just identification of the problem. I it's a start, and I'm supportive of the start.
Okay.
But you've got to fill in the rest of the blanks early on, or otherwise all of a sudden you'll have unfunded mandates come down, and we've all been experienced that. It's
right.
A huge problem for local government.
Right. That was a message that the counties who were present at that meeting delivered loud and clear, and I think the Oregon Health Authority heard. You know, if you want to get these people back in the community for housing and treatment, that's great, but it cannot become an unfunded mandate. The state support to do that initially and on an ongoing basis has to be there.
I agree.
Commissioner Hunt, any questions or comments?
Well, I think certainly we need to recognize that funding is an issue, but at the same time, this is a plan. I think it lays the groundwork, it identifies the stakeholders, and puts us in a better position to be able to obtain funding, work with more entities, more organizations to support that funding need. And I had an opportunity to meet with Mr. Sparks and talk about this concept. Part of the next step is to develop a more detailed plan, certainly to look at multiple avenues of fundraising to support the plan. And I think the fact that so many agencies and states have embraced the concept speaks well to that. And it certainly seems to have some valid results, data-driven results. And I'm a big believer that spending a little extra money up front to save money in the long run is the kind of decisions that we need to support. So I agree there's some challenges, but I think there's certainly a lot of reasons to be optimistic about the potential success.
Okay, with that, I would entertain a motion.
I'll move to approve the resolution declaring support of the National Stepping Up Initiative to reduce the number of people with mental illnesses in jails.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. It's so ordered. Thank you all.
Last video?
No, that's okay. Next up is the adoption of the consent calendar, items that are routine or have been discussed at previous meetings. Is there a motion, or is there anything staff or commissioners wish to highlight or remove?
Make a motion to adopt the consent calendar.
I'll second it.
Moved and seconded. All in favor of adopting the consent calendar, please say aye.
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 Aye. We move on to our one decision and action item today and ask our planning staff to come forward. This is a resolution initiating amendments to Ordinance 484, amending temporary regulation of recreational marijuana. And gentlemen, if you'd introduce yourselves for the record, take it away.
Joshua Shackley, Senior Planner with the Planning and Development Department here at the county.
Anno Husing, Director of the Planning and Development Department.
Okay. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Maybe just to talk about the process we're going through here and then let them talk about any of the details. When you make changes to the county code, including the provisions, these are temporary regulations for recreational marijuana. They are not a permanent part of Chapter 1, although they do affect land use in Chapter 1. The process that we go through is that you initiate a review by the Planning Commission of things that you would like to see reviewed. They hold the public hearing on the matter and then make recommendations back to you. So I want to just note up front that this is what we're looking at is some very targeted and limited amendments to the temporary recreational marijuana regulations already in place. Have been in place. This is not intended to be the final action that's taken in this area. The OLCC is still continuing to develop the statewide regulations, and we continue to monitor their progress there. The 2017 legislature is looking at taking another look at certain aspects of this, and so we're not ready to initiate a process, and we look at permanent regulation here. So this is a continuation of the efforts that you've made to date, but they can talk about the particulars now.
Okay.
Again, I'm pleased to do that, but today I think we're here mostly in a
to answer questions from the Board of Commissioners, because as Wayne pointed out to you, that when we first began this odyssey of stepping in and trying to provide some time, place, and manner regulations for dispensaries and grow operations, we recall the board issued temporary regulations. It was a promise to the community for that. That was not the last time we would visit these matters, that as issues came up, we would keep returning to our temporary regulations with the aim of, once the dust settled from the state level about where things were going, that we'd have more clarity, and then we could ultimately move into a final set of recommendations, final set of code amendments. So what we've we keep having this dilemma of saying, are they through yet? Have we reached a point where the dust has settled? And I think we've concluded that's not the case, because it is a complicated new industry with different moving parts. There's stuff going on in the Capitol. There's stuff going on with OAR development. But at least for these two items, people in the county have pointed out that there are some things that don't really make that would be beneficial to have a reexamination of, for instance, the size of the parcels. We created a minimum threshold of 20 acres on agricultural parcels for grow operations. That's one of the two.
For outdoor grow.
Outdoor. And so the point was made by a number of people within the county, responded that, you know, our parcel size for agricultural properties are really unlike some other places in the valley or Deschutes County, where they have much larger parcels. And so when we initially grabbed to try to put something into place during the temporary operations, we took this 20-acre threshold. And for whether that really fits the realities on the ground in Lincoln County, that's come to our attention. It probably doesn't. And so, again, the code initiation process steers us now to have a planning commission meeting we'll be working with our IT department to develop information about parcel sizes in the county and develop the body of information necessary. As Commissioner Thompson often likes to say, let the Planning Commission do its job, work through these issues, get a recommendation coming out of there. The other thing, Joshua, I think you can talk about it too.
Why don't you
handle that one?
Yeah, sure. Okay. The other specific provision that we're going to be reconsidering in pursuing this action is setbacks from these facilities, in particular wholesale facilities and retail outlets for recreational marijuana. The way it's written in Ordinance 484, the setback is 250 feet measured from property line to property line. So it turns out that rules out a whole bunch of properties that are zoned for these facilities as outright permitted uses, but they share a boundary with a residential property, residentially zoned property. So it kind of rules them out for pursuing these types of facilities. So it was an unintended consequence, having pulled this together rather quickly, to just have something in place. So that's another thing we're going to be looking at through the process here.
And that's not unlike what we discovered the first time we did this in South Beach, that we had the same thing. The distance that we placed for parks, not realizing that the sweep and scope of South Beach eliminated any of those industrial properties from having that opportunity. So again, that was something we didn't really anticipate until we started working it on the ground. And so that's why we consider both things a bit of housekeeping. There are some important policy dimensions to this that need to be properly vetted, and that's what we certainly intend to do with the Planning Commission.
So just to recap, if we pass this resolution today, it refers it to staff to basically generate a body of information and possible recommendations to the Planning Commission. Then, as Commissioner Thompson says, the Planning Commission gets to do its work, vet whether there's any validity, justification for changing either of these issues, and bringing back a recommendation to us, correct?
Correct, and then there would be a whole other bite at the apple in terms of addressing the policy issues, and the recommendations came out of the Planning Commission before this body, again, in a transparent process with further public input.
Sure. Comments, questions from commissioners?
Well, this is a process that's going to go through a lot of switches and changes, and the state and the legislature are going to make their changes. But the thing that worries me is the rest of the state has large agricultural production areas. Lincoln County doesn't.
Right.
And if we're going to take any of the opportunity to generate income from an agricultural product, which I believe that marijuana is now an agricultural product, then we'll have to reduce our size down, or otherwise the state can create a law and works for everybody else, but doesn't work for us. And so by passing this, it brings attention at the state level that we have a specific set of problems.
And when we bring this back to you, we'll have some numbers, number of properties affected. You're right that the county doesn't have the large size parcels that you'd find in other counties. So we'll have some numbers to demonstrate that this is the case, that the number of properties. And in the county, a lot of our farmland is along rivers, and they're small parcels, or they're parcels with split zoning with timber conservation zones. So we'll have some numbers to show you and demonstrate what kind of the scope of the issue that we're addressing here.
So if an outcome of the process is we go from the 20 acres to something below that for a threshold to be able to do outdoor grows, one thing that's not on the table for pulling back on is the distance requirement for an outdoor grow 500 feet to a neighboring residence. So we're leaving that check and balance of providing some spatial separation in place. So even as the Planning Commission, you know, works and does the vetting on what is the appropriate minimum threshold level for agricultural parcels, which are only 2 or 3% of Lincoln County, we don't have that kind of agricultural land base to begin with. That's going to stay in place, and I think that's really important that we're not just throwing this thing. And that we don't go from over-regulation to no regulation. There's going to be that very important backstop in there that provides some spatial separation, irrespective of the outcome of the recommendations that come to you.
Okay. Commissioner Hunt, anything at this point?
Well, I just have concerns about, is this the time to do this? I have no problem with addressing the question, but as Director Husing's already indicated, it's going to take time of the Planning Department. It's going to call convening of the Planning Commission. Certainly takes time of our citizens to be available and to testify if they feel the need to do that. And we've been approaching the whole process of the legalization of marijuana on a very purposeful process. We've passed two ordinances on medical marijuana in April of last year and on recreational in December of last year. And we've already indicated that our thought was we'd wait until the dust settles. We recognize we're on an odyssey with future decisions by the legislature. We've got a vote in November that's going to change the composition of the legislature. The legislature is going to have to deal with these issues next year. It's not clear what regulations the OLCC will place on recreational marijuana. It's not clear if the Oregon Health Authority is going to continue to regulate medical marijuana. So to take the time of our county employees to address this rather narrow issue and also take the time of our citizens to be a part of that process when we recognize there's going to be very likely a lot of changes next year that are going to require a reconvening or a recreation of this process or to go through the process a second time. I just think let's wait and see what happens in the next year, and then we can be more comprehensive in addressing the many issues.
Okay. Bill? Yes, Commissioner?
I'd like to respond to that. Being an ex-legislator, and they're going to be considering their areas. And since we have the smallest amount of agriculture in the state of agricultural land and the lowest amount of agricultural production, we won't even be considered unless we have some type of something like this that we can present them to say, look, we're part of this too. Our citizens voted it in, and now they're very likely, if we don't give them some kind of guidelines, we'll be left out. And it will just be thrown in because they won't even think about the problems of not having a lot of agricultural land.
And Commissioner, I am certainly understand your concerns, and interesting to have my words come back to me like, yeah, why don't you wait for the dust to settle? But what we're discovering is that as we really thought in terms that there would be a point of clarity that we would reach, what we're experiencing is that this evolution may go on for several years.
The target's not going to stop.
Right. It's not like we can say, you know what, a lot of the major issues are going to be settled. What we're finding out is that there's a continuation on this. And the idea would be to pull out two really straightforward, rather simple matters. Part of the parcel size, the sense of timing on that, had to do with the people that are going to do an outdoor grow, as I understand it, need to be, you know, like other farmers and ranchers and stuff. It's time sensitive. If we don't adjust this, there are going to be a whole bunch of people that, not even a whole, but there will be some property owners. I was overstating that. There are going to be some property owners that would like to do it that are right now, because we grabbed this very large parcel size, can't do it. And so by the time they get into the ground, let's say we make, and these are matters, the two things that we've carved out, these are things that we did for the county. This isn't, you know, that more or less we created these time, place, and manner issues. So this is kind of within our purview to look at these things, and we carve these out. So what we've created, it really is our job, if there's a need to adjust it, for us to sort of grab that. But your points are well taken. I just think we'll be okay doing this. I'm sorry.
Somebody told me that Jackson County, I believe, had 60,000 growers or something, fabulous number like that, that had moved into. Have you heard that number like that?
Well, I think we all know that Jackson County became early on like ground zero for marijuana cultivation, and we have intuitively, we believe, based on what people have told us, that Lincoln County is not likely to be a major place for outdoor grows, because the weather and the ecological circumstances, soils and climate in southern Oregon is likely to be the place where most of the big outdoor grows happen. I think what we're seeing is a fair amount of indoor grow activity that is taking place in Lincoln County. So I'm not sure that that if we were to adjust the parcel size downward, that we would be creating an awful lot of outdoor grows anyway, based on that we're just, again, our climate and our soils and the scale of operations here don't really lend itself. And it's probably going to be on the eastern side of the county, away from the beach, or again, it's warmer and there's up in the Coast Range, and where some of this outdoor stuff
is. I remember where I heard the name from. Uh-huh. It came from the director of AOC. I had lunch with him after the Highway 20, and he gave me a number, and I can't remember what it was, but I was like, whoa.
Wow.
This is big business.
Yeah.
In some counties.
It's huge.
But that doesn't mean that it can't be a business that does produce revenue and keep some of our... One of the challenges here to being a farmer at all is trying to find something in a small piece of property that can generate enough capital that you can hang on to your farm.
Yeah. I think it's worth looking at for the economic aspect. You know, I'm not an expert on this subject by any means, but I do try to research news and trends. I've read that once Colorado went to legalization, initially most of the growing was indoors, and a significant share of it has moved outdoors. That even though that required growers to make a greater investment in security, they said that was more than offset by the tremendous decrease in energy consumption. And, you know, indoor grows require use of a lot of electricity. And if we're concerned about energy conservation, it's at least something to think about in terms of the bigger mix. And, you know, this is a rapidly evolving industry. And I know that already we're seeing big growers, and that's probably one will be the case in Jackson County, but I've talked to at least a couple of folks who want to position themselves as essentially boutique growers of a more natural, organic product. And if it's a business niche that some people can fill in Lincoln County, then at least I'd like to look at the potential for that.
Okay, one last question. And it's not time to answer the question to you after the Planning Commission, but one of the things we need I won't make it a question statement. One of the things we need to make sure is that we have the enforcement capabilities to make sure that the regulations that do go into place are enforceable. And because this could be a fairly valuable crop out in the rural area, which we have our sheriffs doing enforcement, but it's going to be a new challenge that will come in.
Commissioner Thompson, I'm glad you said it, because remind me of, in our office right now, we're developing we realize that when we sign land use compatibility statements for thus far indoor grows primarily, that we're asking ourselves, all right, we sign off on these things, and are we, because they're able to take advantage of agricultural building permits, or are we even providing our own oversight to make sure after we sign off on a land use compatibility statement that they're in compliance with things? So, right, Joshua, we're creating an internal process to provide that kind of oversight to make sure people are following through on what's happening. And again, these are when we encounter people that are acting professionally as they move forward in this industry, they're not seeing any of these things as huge obstacles. And they said they get it. Their point is, this is a highly regulated industry. We need to comply. If we're going from something that was black market to now a highly regulated industry, that what we're putting on the table is not something that they won't be able to do. But it's very hard to predict exactly how much and where and how. I've heard, for instance, when it comes to outdoor grows, that as hemp, not marijuana use for medical or recreational purposes, but hemp, the fiber, as that gets reintroduced into the landscape, some growers have told us, we would not want to go outdoors, because as those plants begin to send off their pollen, it's going to intermix with the outdoor marijuana, and it's going to ruin it. And by God, that's why they want to be indoors. So look, we can't become experts in marijuana cultivation. We have to rely on people in the public and try to understand as much as we can and create a level playing field that makes sense and adjust over time, and not let it, you know, this has been a very big burden on all of us. Belmont has had to spend a lot of time dealing with the marijuana stuff, so it's been a challenge from the beginning to try to do this and do this correctly, but we just want to make it, we think these two items are not going to bankrupt us in terms
of somebody approached me before the meeting. Are you okay if we see if there's any public comment or questions now? You're okay, sure. Is there anybody who has questions or comments?
I have some comments. I'm Pat Morford.
Should we stand down?
Can you come forward, please, because we record the meetings and just want to have everything on the record.
My daughter and I have been in contact with all of you, except Wayne. I haven't seen Wayne in 30 years. But anyway, we've been in contact with you about this. We have a family farm out in the East County, and we have a dairy, and it's a successful dairy. But as a small farm, we cannot afford to supply living wage jobs for employees. So we struggle with that. And as cannabis as a value-added agricultural crop, it would really, really be a boon to us, because we could then afford to pay people a living wage. My daughter and I work 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and Astria has not had a day off in years. So it would really be a boon to us agriculturally to have a high-value crop like that that takes up a very small amount of acreage. It is less than an acre of land that the crop takes, and that's what's allowed by the state. There's 24-hour surveillance that they check in on from the state. It's all required. Everything is very high security, and it is in place. You know, you have to have it in order to do it, and we are very happy to comply with all of that. But as a value-added agricultural crop, it is a boon to us if we can get it in the ground and get it growing. And that's basically what I'd like to say. I really appreciate all of your help, the planners, everyone, all of the commissioners. It's really terrific that you're really helping us out with this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your input. Was there anybody else? Okay. Is there a motion to adopt this resolution?
I'll
make the motion.
I feel the timing is inappropriate.
Okay. Then I will second this motion to initiate amendments to Ordinance 484, amending temporary regulation of recreational marijuana. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. We move on now to a report on jail facilities, maintenance, and structure update. Sergeant Graham and Maintenance Supervisor Jack Whaley.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Sergeant Tom Graham. I work for your Sheriff's Office, and I'm assigned to your jail. Wanted to take the time this morning to make a presentation on kind of state of the jail. We periodically like to keep you updated on what's happening. I picked three topics related to this, which is the state of the jail, the physical building itself, and how it's functioning, and then the state of the county functions that we manage in the Sheriff's Office. There's some procs and cameras and things like that that we manage as a whole for the county. And then with that, the county personnel challenges that come with managing both the jail and those other projects. I have Jack Whaley with me from our maintenance department, and he's kind of here to fill in and answer the questions as they come along. I want to start with the jail and say that, you know, we strive to maintain the jail at the highest level of sanitation, safety, and security. It's important to both the inmates and the staff. We do this through our strong partnerships with the facilities maintenance, our IT department, Board of Commissioners, County Council, and all our other partners. We do a lot of things like use inmate labor to clean and paint the interior of the building. We use them for special assignment when preparing surplus items. And I'll use an example yesterday. We actually surplus 8 pallets of furniture and cabinetry for the county auction that came out of the jail project. Inmates put them neatly on pallets and got them over there. So we constantly seek new sources for products that are beneficial to meet those three, you know, the safety, security, and sanitation. And with these items, we dedicate a lot of time in the jail. Our staff do research and go out and shop. And then, of course, Jack's time spent, you know, looking for products to help us in our IT department. The things that we've accomplished in recent history is we were funded and replaced the call box system, which improved communication in the jail. We remodeled the admin conference area to increase capacity and function. We remodeled the staff dining area to accommodate more staff. We updated the jail door control software. We installed our last, or we're installing our last segment of flush control in APOD this next month. And that is a big deal for us. I'm going to stop there and say that it has reduced the number of floods we've had. It's reduced the number of items going out into the city sewer system. I have not heard from our friends at the city in a long time, so I take this as a success. Jack can attest to the nasty calls we used to get, rightfully so, the amount of stuff going through the sewer system. We're replacing aging lighting with more efficient LEDs. We installed a new boiler system for hot water. We've replaced a lot of aging pipes. We've installed prox access to areas in the jail where we felt was appropriate from a security point of view. We're in the process of replacing the software and some of the hardware that drives the video system for the county as a whole. That's actually occurring this week. We're in the planning for a remodel of the jail lobby to improve security and customer service. We're doing some installation of heat air pumps in critical areas to manage environment. We've got the addition of the county communication microwave system now sits inside of the jail, so we're improving environmental controls for that. We have the constant repair or replacement from inmate damage. That is nearly a weekly thing. We sustained damage this week in our public restroom. A gentleman ripped a partition right off the wall. We're looking at probably $2,000 worth of damage before we get done. And then, of course, we're always working on our technical systems. We're expanding our jail management software to include an electronic medical record system. It's a project we've been working on for about a year. We're very close to deploying it. What's on the horizon for the jail? Well, this might come across as a little doom and gloom, but it's really just being proactive and making you aware of the things that we see coming along that we want to plan for and repair. A lot of them you saw on your tour this week. The doors and locks in the jail are all 25 years old and require more frequent replacement and repairs. A lot of maintenance with our maintenance department coming over and repairing airlines, replacing locks. They have to take the time to research and find replacement parts. Sometimes they're no longer available. We have to find a suitable replacement. It can be very challenging when you have a building that's 25 years old and they don't have a retrofit part for it. So you get pretty creative. We have a 25-year-old fire suppression and alarm system that we've managed to keep pasted together. It seems to be functioning, but it does require regular maintenance. We're challenged right now with inmate ADA requirements. That's a hot topic coming through to us, and so we're having to make some changes with that. We also have some sanitation issues surrounding our stock showers. I know you guys saw that this week. We're working with our maintenance department to discuss long-term what we can do to, A, meet the ADA requirements and improve the sanitation in those areas. We are looking at a booking remodel due to aging workstations and functionality. As you change and do business differently, how the counter sits isn't always how you need the counter to be. So we want to look long-term at what we can do to improve the workflow, increase efficiency, and certainly make the environment better. We have windows that leak and are damaged. It's an ongoing process for our maintenance department to get in and replace windows. It's either inmate damage, age, or weather. And it's no easy task, as well, our building's about six stories tall, technically. Our rec yards have external steel expanded metal cages that block, that allows the air to come in. Those are rusting and are coming very close to needing to be replaced. One of the things that goes with that is poor design. When the jail was built, most of our rec yards are on the west side of the building where all the weather comes in. And so we actually have to close our rec yards quite a bit during the winter time, reducing the availability of that area for the inmates. And we have some requirements legally to get them out to that area and provide them that activity. So it's been a challenge. We're looking at maybe some solutions long term to allow that rec yard to continue to work, get the fresh air, get the light, but not have the wet floors. We have failing pipes. Some have been replaced. We've got a lot of miles to go. The unfortunate part about the pipes is when you replace one piece, you kind of have a cascading effect downhill and you start to see pinholes occur. So we continue to have environmental control issues. We have an aging air handling system, a very interesting way of routing heating. So we use example, we turn the boilers back on for the season to heat the building back up, and it always identifies what's failed. We had some rooms reach tropical, and we have some rooms in the Arctic state, so they're balancing those out for us. We currently use a portion of the jail for evidence storage. I'm going to suggest in the future that we probably will reach capacity for that area and may have to look at other resources. We also have that took up a chunk of the jail's central storage area, and so we are constantly shuffling things around for our supplies. It takes a lot to run a jail, and we have to get very creative where we stick pallets of toilet paper and paper towels and clothing and stuff. So we are having a real estate problem there. We're working on increasing the jail Wi-Fi network, thanks to our IT department, to accommodate new technologies coming soon. We do have some concerns with the location of some of our IT department's network equipment as it relates to jail water and power supplies, and we've been in long-term talks about this. Basically, we have some server closets with pipes running over the top of them, and I'll refer back to the previous statement about the aging pipes. That is doom and gloom, so we've got that on our priority list. Our pod officer stations are in need of upgrading due to use and efficiency. This is all stuff that we're looking at long term, just knowing that 25 years the counters are wearing out, the equipment that holds them up is needing to be looked at. And I spoke with Jack, our building exterior is going to be painted this next spring. And then just generally, we have leaks and general space issues for inmates and operations. We've reached the capacity of our building in a lot of ways. We're getting very creative to make sure that we get all these activities going. We have a lot of inmate programs going on, and they compete for limited space, but we're making it happen. State of the County Act projects that we work on. Currently, we're managing over 170 cameras. Approximately 90 doors are on the County Unified Access Control System with over 150 users. That includes the jail, courthouse, personnel, HHS, Lee Street, HHS Nye Street, HHS Lincoln City, animal shelter, juvenile, transit office, the new parking lot, the boat and impound yard, and I probably forgot a couple buildings. We replaced cameras in the courthouse on the first and second floor this last 2 years. and we've moved all of the courthouse doors on the first and second floor to the new Cisco control system. Our future or existing projects include the addition of cameras to the road department compound. We're working on that this fall in cooperation with the maintenance department. Replacement of the courthouse and jail complex exterior cameras. We have inadequate coverage of the general complex, and the cameras we do have are 25 plus years old in some cases. We're replacing all the cameras on the courthouse third floor. This was funded by an OJD source, one-time expenditure, and we're very close to completing that. We're also moving all the state court offices and rooms to the Cisco PROC system so we can close down the old PROC access control system finally and let it go.
Excuse me if I may interrupt. Is the court system the only area of the county that's still on that old system?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep. We are installing the cameras over in the new parking lot for overall public and employee safety, and obviously to be able to record if there's events that occur in that area. It's well lit. The cameras we picked will go to night and day, so some added advantage there.
And do I understand that we'll also have cameras in the new transitional housing? That
we will.
Parole and probation.
That is the next item. We're planning the installation of procs and cameras in new transition housing. This is from a couple different funding sources, including DPSST, community justice, and other county funds. We really looked at that project and said, hey, this is a good time to get at the ground floor and establish some basic security protocols for that area. We have a pending remodel up in Lincoln City for HHS, and so there will be some changes in door control up there. We've had some conversation about our microwave sites and how we enhance the security there and how we get communication to there. So if we had to put surveillance in there or prox access, and that's kind of an ongoing conversation, but those are areas that really do need enhanced security. And then just overall, continued building security, you know, our checkpoint and all county buildings, we're always looking at how we can improve it for the citizens and the employees that work there. Some of the challenges for these is just obviously the sustainable funding for existing systems and having needed discussions. And then people. And I guess really wanted to get down to opening the door and talking about how people are used. You know, and I mentioned several partnerships, but probably one of the strongest is maintenance and IT and myself in the sheriff's office. We work to accomplish a lot of these county projects and manage them, but we're running into is between the three of us, we no longer have the sufficient staff to provide the level of service we feel the county deserves. I'll reference first with our maintenance department. The jail puts a tremendous amount of pressure on them. We are a consumer of their resources. I told Jack that's my sole job is to drain him dry most of the time. But the jail,
at least you're honest about it.
Sounds like you've been successful.
Partnerships. You know, the jail really is a lot of work. It's a 24-hour building. It's not, you know, and everything that we touch is twice as old just by virtue of its use. So they spend a lot of time coming over and kind of patching things together for us. But we also have a lot of staff now that have picked up maintenance functions to take some burden off of them. So I have deputies changing light bulbs, air filters, and ceiling tiles on a regular basis because they know that if we don't do it ourselves, there's going to be a lag there. No fault of Jack's, but his priority is not my light bulb, it's the broken pipe down the road. So we've taken on a lot of that, and we, you know, it's fine, but at some point our threshold is going to be met where it's not practical, and certainly it's not cost effective to have a deputy changing light bulbs. And it takes two of them, if there was a joke about that. Also, our IT department, we put the same type of expectation and pressure on them. They have, again, another phenomenal relationship, and he knows that I'm working to pretty much drain him of all his resources, but they have made it possible for the sheriff's office and the jail to be as technically advanced as they are and as efficient as they are, and you continue, you know, and the staff to make all of that possible. But as we add things to the jail, we add to their responsibilities of maintaining. And I'll use the example, the video system used to actually be maintained by the, more or less, the maintenance department because it was a low, you know, it wasn't a big deal. But now it's on the county network, and that equipment has to be in a replacement cycle. I'm not the guy to do it. He's not the guy to do it. It's the guy back there. And so planning and keeping them in the loop, and now we're putting a fiscal pressure on them to add that to their, you know, replacement cycle, and most of our servers are between 4 and 6 years, and they're not cheap. So we recognize that when I ask for something or we ask for something, it's got a long-term effect. It's going to cascade. We did a lot of contracting of work out the last couple of years, and that's fine, but what I'm starting to see now is, it used to be I would add a camera somewhere, I'd go do it myself. It took me 30 minutes. Or I'd have Jack and his crew come help me and we'd ping the camera. We don't have the time to do that, and it's not necessarily the most efficient use of, well, my time, but or Jack's time, but his crew's not available to do it anymore, so we're paying contractors upwards of $2,000 to come hang a single camera, and it gets expensive after a while. We all have taken on the role of project management and fiscal management, so we're taking on things in the county that, you know, like managing or installing, I'll use the road department. Jack came with a need, I met with him providing consulting between the IT, maintenance, and ourselves. We're putting this project together and making it happen, but it takes a portion of our time to manage that project. And so we see in the future, at some point, we're going to need the staffing levels to accommodate a lot of these things I've just talked about. You know, I will say straightforward that the IT department and the maintenance department really do need additional people to keep up with the county infrastructure. And I will say that the county infrastructure is at, I think, a good place right now, and I would really like to keep it there between IT and maintenance. They provide a high level of service, but I can see it slipping and it's coming fast.
Yeah, and I think that's something we're going to have to confront. You know, we've got a couple of big building projects on the horizon, the new HHS building, the new exhibition hall at the Commons. That's just going to stress these systems even further. Commissioner Thompson.
Jack, how do you deal with this? We keep acquiring more property, more...
What's happened is I have let the menial tasks drop. HHS has hired personnel that basically do what we used to do, moving of furniture, hanging of pictures, this sort of thing. So every department that used to depend on us for these tasks has now had to branch out into their own and create these positions within their own departments. Normally, I would fight tooth and nail to recapture that position and bring it into the maintenance fold. But right now, we're taxed to the point where I would much rather see them create those positions and get the jobs done for them in a timely manner, because if they're counting on us, it will be a wait. We take care of right now more or less on a fireman's schedule. We're capturing it as they break. We're holding it up. We'll make the repairs. I contract everything. And in a standard management model, that would be cheaper than having a full-time personnel to contract out. But it's getting to the point now where our contractor base is not at the technical level that we need. I can't count on troubleshooting our internal systems from someone like, you know, Above Board or some of the other contractors in the area. They don't have the technological level that we need, and they don't have the knowledge of the interior infrastructure.
So let me ask the question. There's all kinds of maintenance people. We have everybody from, we have some guys that are experts in carpentry. What would you bring on next? It sounds like you're looking at somebody that's...
Our technical level has climbed. I do not bring on just we won't be hiring menial labor. I mean, yes, I have a use for that. It's cheaper for me to contract that out because of the technical level. What I need is to bring on intelligent people at an entry level and get them licensed in the fields that are necessary. My new person, Mike, as soon as he got on board, I accelerated his tech level. He's already a boiler operator. He's licensed. He's this close to getting his limited maintenance electrical license. And I may go ahead and send him to a low voltage class as well. When I'm done with him, he's going to be at a tech level that, if we're not paying him well enough, we'll lose him.
Okay, this is my question. Would you mind coming up and we sit here? Your department is IT, but it sounds like we're getting into almost an area where this person is going to be IT and maintenance. It's a, how do we work this out? I mean,
historically, the line me and Todd have drawn is between analog and digital.
That works pretty well for us.
Yes, if it deals in the analog world, which radios, voltage, non-digital items. If it touches his server, once we make that transition where the equipment becomes purely data, that's the line we draw.
Okay, let me. So you've established the line there, and by him having another person that's more technologically, can does that help you?
Well, if he has more time, I mean, for example, if he had a low voltage guy that could do small things, that would help us immensely. I mean, we have lots of low voltage work. I don't talk about big projects. I'm talking about, you know, we need a camera here. And it has to be a low voltage electrician licensed by the state. We are just scheduling that someone to get here takes weeks. And we spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars an hour for them to do the work. So, and with the expansion of cameras and the doors, just the repositioning of a camera because, you know, the state says it needs to be here instead of there, it would save us immense amounts
of money. Let me ask you a question then. So now you're going to give me a parameters of what you need, but this person is going to be different than your average. So what kind of, are there many of these type of people available that would go to work?
They're out there. But right now, what I'm looking at is bringing a person in and training them. I'll have trade-specific training. I have to. Not only do we have the low-voltage person, but I also, well, like Mike is wearing two hats because he's got his boiler certification. So that was a smaller task that I could capture. So I double-licensed him. So he's going to be an odd duck. And I'll have to cross-train across many trades, not only the electrical, but the construction and plumbing. I mean, who would have thought we would have combined electricity and plumbing? I mean, but what we've created, and network. You have the smartest toilets in the county.
Okay. It's all about current flow.
I mean, can you imagine the person that it takes to not only know that system, on the digital portion, we need a man for that. We also need a man for the low voltage portion, and that's all powered through a high voltage system. So not only do I need electricians, I need millwrights, I need plumbers, and I also need low voltage electricians. Okay. And those guys aren't out there. You have to make them.
Okay.
And the problem is once you've made them, you've made a very marketable person.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, there's the maintenance problem, guys, that we haven't faced before. It's a new era. Looking at.
And I wanted to kind of add a little bit about some of the work that Jack does as project management. Mm-hmm. You know, we've taken individually some of the things off of his shoulder, but anytime we're doing something substantial, okay, lobby remodel, we have to get his time involved and his resources involved, and he's got all these other things going on. So we're really faced with a project management issue as well. I do a lot of, you know, for the security cameras and door control, and that's fine, but at some point the county's probably going to need a role there as well because we keep adding buildings. And
if you ask anybody that's had to deal with my paperwork, it's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, while I can, my role in the physical world, I'm okay with, the paperwork portion for me is a bloody nightmare. And project management portion to that is...
So we're not going to solve this problem right here.
But at least this helps to identify it. And it
creates an awareness.
You know, and
please know that while we ponder this problem, we're living the problem.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, back in 2009 and 10 when we had to cut so severely throughout the organization, IT and facilities and maintenance took their cuts along with everybody else. And as we have rebuilt, we've added back some capacity in those departments, but they're not even at the level I don't think they were when we made the cuts, and yet we've grown substantially since.
Well, that's it. We keep growing.
And it's not the general fund. It's the outside funds like Health and Human Services. What do we hear? 80-85% growth since 2011, and none of that's general fund money. It's all the state and federal flow of dollars.
So, but we still, the maintenance comes from general.
Exactly.
So, well, the commission.
Well, I have a question. Just help me learn. Talked about analog and digital, and you talked about low voltage. Where's low voltage?
Low voltage is in both areas.
It is.
There's certification boards certify electricians in several chunks. You have high voltage electricians, which are your linemen, transformer people. They deal with the incoming power to your home. You have the residential electrician who would basically rope your house with wire and maintain your circuitry. You have limited maintenance licensing, which allows a person to change light bulbs, fix outlets. And then you have maintenance licensing, which allows them to change 480 volt pumps, processes, and motor control units, which is what we use mostly. But and then below that, and I don't say that below that is in a technical level, I say that in just a voltage level, you have the 10 to 24 volt systems that all of these magical pieces of equipment operate on. Now, to ask somebody in the high voltage world to work on your door controls, you're taking him out of his technical expertise, and you may not get the results you want. So there are specialists within that field, and that's where I'm relying on ad hoc training at this point. But there are folks out there that have a real grasp on it, but they're not going to, you know, you're not going to get them for labor or wages, you know.
Well, Sergeant Graham, thank you for a very comprehensive report, and gentlemen, thank you for broadening the perspective a bit and kind of helping with our ongoing education about organizational needs.
So, may I ask one last question? Budget cycle. I know it sounds like you need the guy yesterday, but can we get through the budget cycle to get the person?
Just know we're at your mercy. So, when, as soon as you can, it would be appreciated. If it takes the next budget cycle, I'll take what I can get, believe me.
I wonder if we should evaluate the possibility of...
We have some work to do.
Let's look at this further.
I'd like to take a moment, though, to recognize the cooperation of all the departments working together.
Yeah. This is
under difficult
cooperation.
We recognize
in
that and the efforts that you make to work together and, you know, help each other out is commendable, and I want to say thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
All righty, now we move on to commissioner reports. First up, I would like to make a public announcement that the annual Lincoln County Community and Economic Development Fund grant applications are available. The full news release is on our in our packet, the last page in our packet. It's also posted on the county website. We've got $100,000 available, our usual yearly allocation to this fund, available for local government entities and qualifying nonprofits. They're eligible for grants of up to $15,000, and we have now passed an interesting milestone. Since this program was initiated by the Board of Commissioners in 2001, we have awarded $2,070,000 to local governments and community organizations, and again, this is from part of our share of local video lottery revenue play. So again, I'd encourage people who are interested in learning more about this to visit the county website. Applications available right now. Deadline, they have to be submitted in person in our office no later than 5 p.m. on Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. That's all I've got. Other reports from commissioners?
Well, I'll report that I had the honor to speak at the Plan a Great event. I believe both my fellow commissioners were in attendance. I think it's important to note a couple of things. Number one, the new highway is expected to open to traffic by the 15th. That's part of the contract with the construction company. So we can expect that highway to see vehicles on it by the 15th of October. But I think it's important to note a couple of things. Number one, the closures that are scheduled for the West End will continue through the end of October. So even though the highway, the new highway is open, the closures at the west end where they're blasting will still be in effect through the end of October. After the end of October, there should be no more overnight closures. Next year, there will still be some work done before the final alignment is in place. But again, under the contract, overnight closures will not be allowed, and there may be some two-hour closures, but those are expected to be minimal, too. So the highway will be open, but there'll still be activities at the west end.
Great.
Well, let me mention, I was up there at the play on the grade, which was, I wasn't ready for the amount of people that were there.
Yeah,
it's incredible. Was it close to 1,000, would I hear somebody say?
I don't know, it seemed like there was 1,000 bikers there.
Yeah.
Most of them coming from, looked like the east. When I came out of there, I'd see most of the bike racks were headed toward the valley, but it was way beyond what I expected, and of course, I got there a little toward the end, because I was down at the bottom of the hill. That's a long hill to walk up. There were that many cars there packed in. Great job. It was a nice day. Didn't think the weather was going to be very good. It was a nice day and it was kind of a neat event. I'm glad that I went.
Good. Good turnout.
The other thing that I attended was the senior fair in Lincoln City yesterday, and also a quality event, lots of information there, quite a few seniors there. It was a well done event, and I enjoyed it, picked up some information, spent quite a bit of time talking to some of the local politicians up there. Just we had the time to sit and talk that I don't normally have. It was good.
Excellent. Now is the time reserved on the agenda for constituent input. Up to 5 minutes on any topic. Do we have any constituent input?
Oh, yeah. I also have a guy.
Okay.
Yes, you did. I'm Richard Sherlock. I'm a peer support specialist with the mental health department. I'm also on the community advisory council for the regional IHNCCO. Last night, Bill and I were at a community talk thing for the...
Community Forum, the CCO, is part of their public outreach process each year. They do one of these in each of the three counties, and this was Lincoln County's annual program.
And it occurred to me that, and Bill says how when a person enters the jail as an inmate, their Medicaid is suspended instead of simply revoked, which is better because they'll have their Medicaid when they get out of jail instead of having to reapply. However, Dennis Buckmaster triages, and evidently, like you were talking about earlier, there's lots of people that need the mental health treatment or some kind of therapy and help, but there's no way of funding it or affording them. And I'm going to go through the local CAC, the local health advisory committee, through the CAC, and see if the CCO can talk to Oregon Health Authority. Because I talked to Ellen Franklin, who was in billing with Lincoln County Health and Human Services. She's the chairman of the CAC. She says that the determination of whether the person in a jail can use their Medicaid is not made by the local CCO, it's made by the Oregon Health Authority.
Right.
So I was thinking what the commissioners could do was, at first I thought, well, write a letter to the Oregon Health Authority so that they would consider this matter and maybe open it up to people in jails. And then I said, well, you're the commissioner for this county, officially you could speak to other counties, maybe get 10 or 15 counties, all of them petitioning the Oregon Health Authority, and this might have some effect. That's my suggestion.
Great idea, Richard, and I don't know if you know, I'm going to be actually be taking over as president of the Oregon Association of Counties next month, and this is an issue we have talked about extensively, and maybe a letter from with as many commissioners who are interested signing on could do something about that, because, I know you're aware, but not everybody watching may be aware that, under federal law, what used to be the practice is once you were incarcerated, even if you were just being held on charges, not found guilty of anything, your Medicaid was terminated. Then they've given the states the option, and Oregon is one who has signed on. We're what's called one of the suspension states, where your benefits are suspended once you're incarcerated, and it's a little easier to get them turned back on when you're released. But it's interesting. They have something called the 23-hour rule. Say somebody has a health crisis, whether it's physical health or mental health, and they have to go to jail. As long as they stay 23 hours or less, it still ends up being on our dime because they're in our custody. But if they're held at the have to be in the hospital 24 hours or more, then their Medicaid kicks back in. So this is something, you know, talk about unfunded mandates that we're dealing with right now. Inmate health care is really one of them. And if we can get some policy change at this, that would be wonderful as far as I'm concerned.
And it would be cheaper in the long run.
Right. Yeah, don't let somebody get to a physical health or a mental health crisis where they have to go to the hospital, you know, get them the treatment. You know, we do have physical health care in the jail with our nursing staff, but, you know, again, our inmate counselor, one counselor for 161 people, it's just a matter of, you know, again, time limitations that the level of attention and care he can give to individual patients is limited, so... This is part, you know, this really, I think, to me, ties in with stepping up and some of the larger challenges we've got in both health policy reform and criminal justice reform.
If I could, I'd like to clarify, maybe Lieutenant Russell can either confirm my understanding or correct my understanding. But my understanding is, even though the Medicaid funding is suspended, we're still providing the medication to those inmates?
That's correct.
Right. Okay. Just to clarify, particularly for our viewers.
Yeah, they do receive medication, but there's no, like, say, mental health.
So we're doing it on our dime.
Yeah.
We are providing peer support services.
Yes.
Because Patrick's got another peer support. It's gone over there several times, at least I know that for sure.
Yeah.
But Barb Turrell decided it's indigent care. We don't bill for it. Mm-hmm. But we are providing some. I mean, my counterpart. Mm-hmm. But not a full-time therapist counselor. We can't really afford to do that on a regular basis.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Good point.
Appreciate the input. All right. I believe we're now ready to recess into executive session, which we will be doing pursuant to ORS 192.660-2H to discuss litigation matters. Do we expect to reconvene in public session?
No.
Okay, we do not, says Mr. Belmont. So our next public meeting will be 1 week from today, Wednesday, October 12th, 9:30, here at the courthouse. We'll take a brief recess, then reconvene to executive session.